From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Extreme vetting unleashes global chaos. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point. President Trump's executive order banning refugees and barring immigrants from seven Muslim-majority countries is just 3 days old, but it's already upended hundreds of lives, drawn tens of thousands of protesters to airports around the nation, and spawned five federal lawsuits, as well as global outcry from across the political spectrum. Why is a defining campaign promise causing such confusion, and is it constitutional? Fallout from the travel ban, that's coming up. And on today's Talking Point, how Mexico's president laid the foundation for the wall. A Peña Nieto critic gives his perspective on the U.S.-Mexico standoff. First news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
We're back with To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney. Later in the show, Mexico's president won't be at the White House this week after that tweet for tat with President Trump. But the two men have a lot in common, even if the two countries are talking about a trade war. We'll hear reaction from Mexico. First, our main story. It's been 3 days since Trump signed an executive order banning all refugees and restricting travel by immigrants. But the consequences have been fast and far-reaching. Travelers were detained, protested. Escalated at airports in many U.S. cities, and some top Republicans have criticized the order as too broad. Trump has hit back, insisting this is not about religion, just terrorism. Hannah Lamb covers race, culture, and identity for McClatchy, where she served as bureau chief in Baghdad and Cairo. She joins us now from Washington. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what's your impression of the White House's reaction so far to the criticism of the travel ban here on day three of the rollout? Sean Spicer appears to avoid calling on any reporters with questions about it and gave generic answers like we're putting Americans' safety first and not being reactive.
Right. We've heard the administration's response evolve over the weekend. I mean, first there was sort of this parallel universe response where President Trump came out and said, it's been a success. Look at the airport, which, of course, were scenes of chaos and separation and anxiety for many travelers. Then there was some administration officials who came out with sort of half clarifications on, you know, what happens to permanent residents. But really, immigration attorneys say only made the situation murkier. This morning, you know, President Trump was more defiant and even making fun of critics like Senator Schumer. And now, right now at the White House, we have, you know, Press Secretary Sean Spicer even invoking the, you know, calling it basically a success and necessary and a preemptive measure and pointing to the deadly tragedy, the mosque shooting in Canada yesterday, to say, in effect, see why we need this. So it's been a pretty sort of erratic response. There hasn't been one coordinated, you know, response from the administration for sure.
And how are Republicans reacting to the rollout?
Well, it they were sort of avoiding saying things in the beginning, and then there were some voices of criticism, and then more broadly, you see even people who support Trump's initiative in general are saying, you know, really sort of criticizing the rollout and saying that, hey, you know, yeah, we need, you know, I can see taking a pause and seeing where we are national security wise, but gosh, this, you know, there had to be, have been a better way.
And update us on the international response to the order so far. How is it reverberating in U.S. relations abroad?
Oh, well, you know, one can really only look, needs to look at Iraq, where, you know, I think this morning, the recently, he just left his post, Ambassador Luqman Faili of Iraq, said he'd been informed that by the U.S. Embassy that he was no longer welcome back in Washington under this order. And he called it a betrayal, as have other U.S. allies. And they've said, you know, how can you ask us for assistance and work together and coordinate on the fight against terrorism and extremism in Iraq and Syria, and then at the same time say, oh, by the way, you're not welcome. So that's been a particular friction.
And clarify for us exactly, since the chaos is ongoing, who is targeted by this entry order now? The White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, and the new head of Homeland Security said yesterday that green card holders would no longer be detained, but there's still confusion on the ground.
It's absolutely still in limbo. Yes, and even though Homeland Security and Reince Priebus came out to ostensibly give us some clarification on green card holders, they also added this extra thing saying, you know, essentially, you know, barring any indication or, you know, damaging information or information that suggests that you might be a security threat, you'd have no problem coming in. So, you know, immigration attorneys I spoke with said, well, what does that mean? Is it a values test? Are you going to be quizzing permanent residents at borders about their beliefs? And who gets to decide? And how is that information collected? So they still had a lot of questions and areas of concern.
And what legal challenges to the ban are in the pipeline now? There have already been five lawsuits to come out of this, and I understand there are more.
Oh, yes, many more. In fact, there's one clearinghouse online for the lawsuits, and it says, I think it, by its count, it's got 30 legal challenges now across the country. The Council of American Islamic Relations, one of the largest Muslim advocacy groups in the nation, just filed within the past hour, filed a new lawsuit. This one's challenging the constitutionality of the order itself, arguing that, you know, it's singling out of Islam is the violation of the Establishment Clause is unconstitutional.
Hannah Lam with McClatchy, thank you so much. You're going to be staying with us for our main conversation. I appreciate it. And all of you, stay tuned. In a moment, more about why one of the biggest campaign promises has been so hard to implement smoothly. And we'll look at the legal challenges to the travel ban in greater depth. Stay with us for that conversation. Back in a moment with To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And let's continue our conversation about the rocky rollout of President Trump's sweeping executive order from Friday. It spawned chaos and protests at major airports across the country and lawsuits in five federal courts. It bars entry to all refugees from anywhere in the world for 120 days. It also blocks any visitors from Muslim-majority countries of Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen for 90 days. Jennifer Rubin writes the conservative Right Turn blog for The Washington Post, and she joins us now. Good of you to talk with us on the program today.
Nice to be here, Barbara.
So this was a defining campaign promise for more than a year. Why such a chaotic rollout?
Because no one in the White House has ever been in the White House before. Donald Trump has never held public office. Steve Bannon was the publisher of this very extreme right-wing website. Reince Priebus actually never held public office. He's been a politician in the sense of running state and obviously the national party. And the people who are experienced are out in the cabinet departments and, from what we can tell, have been marginalized, pushed off to the side, not thoroughly consulted. And this has been cooked up by Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, who was the longtime aide to Jeff Sessions, also has never been in the White House, without any conception that this is different than a campaign. In the campaign, you just put out a white paper and whatever. People comment, people get upset, you go on TV, you explain it. Governance is hard. It's an enormous bureaucracy. There are 1,000 questions that are going to take place with any initiative, particularly one as sort of cockeyed as this one. And they simply are incompetent, unprepared to deal with it. And when they double down and deny that there's chaos, of course, they simply confirm this growing sensation that they're either committed liars or intellectually incompetent in some sense.
Are you saying that this was administrative incompetence or outright lack of concern for the legality of the order? Because they're, well, and they're very different. And some reports
It
that Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly was on the phone with officials at the White House while President Trump was signing the order, that there was virtually no legal vetting that went into this.
No, I think there's overlap there. I think they are careless. I think they are incompetent because they don't care. I think they're one and the same. They're extremely arrogant. It all goes back to their arrogance. They don't care about the law. They don't care about the details. They don't care about the administration. They are out there making campaign promises come to life. And that's how Trump has always operated, on his image, on flash, no attention to the substance, no attention to the details. And we see that right here. Your previous guest said there are 30 lawsuits already. I'm sure there are going to be hundreds by the time the week is out. And some of those will fall by the wayside. Others may succeed. And the pressure is, in fact, rising not only on Democrats, but on Republicans. I spent quite a bit of time over the weekend, for example, talking to the office of Senator Portman, who had a incident that really sort of stunned and should encapsulate reaction to this. There was a doctor, female doctor, coming to the Cleveland Clinic, a renowned clinic, which is the place from which our nominee for the Veterans Affairs emanated from. That person was turned back, put on a plane, and moments later, the ban was clarified that because she was a greenholder, she could come in. But too late, she's out of the country now. So I think it's indicative of the difficulty that lawmakers are going to have when problems are existing in their own districts. This is a real on-the-ground problem. That's why you saw senators go out to airports. That's why you see senators going on television, trying to figure out what's going on, trying to lead assistance. You now see a very significant effort by big business. You have Starbucks, you have other big companies putting out information that we will stand behind you. We're trying to figure this out. We're working on ways to get you into the country. So it's not just a bunch of cranky activists. This is business. This is senators on both sides of the aisle. This has real-world ramifications, and of course, on the foreign policy front, it's an utter disaster. Iraq is our ally. How can we ban their officials from entering our country? That's how crazy this is.
We should pick up on the thread that you mentioned, Steve Bannon's role in this, and he's recently been promoted to an expanded role in national security policy, and that's unleashed just a great deal of consternation on both sides of the political aisle. Susan Rice, the former national security advisor under President Obama, just called it stone cold crazy. But the White House, and in the recent press conference, this morning's press conference, the White House is framing this as everyone's misreporting this.
No, it's not being misreported. They are including a politician who has a very dark, peculiar worldview, who has no experience in national security, into one of the most important settings, which is the National Security Council. What's more, they're taking out of what's called the Principals meeting, the Principals Committee, which is where a lot of the decision-making is taking place. The Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs is no longer a permanent attendee. This is the debasement, the sheer politicization of national security. The country would have had a meltdown had, for example, Karl Rove been a constant in the National Security Council under George Bush. There was one or two instances, I believe, when David Axelrod sat in on some discussions about Afghanistan, didn't comment, sat in the back row, was just listening, and people had a meltdown over that. This is precisely what people feared, that Donald Trump's future and current inability to accept reality, his desire to meld it and twist it to meet his political views and to satisfy his base, will do grave danger to the country domestically, and now I think we see internationally.
Well, Jennifer Rubin, we know you have to run. I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jennifer Rubin with The Washington Post. Let's turn back now to Hannah Alam. We were talking earlier, and Jennifer mentioned we have GOP senators put in a corner by this policy. What specific senators are struggling with this?
I must say I've been on the phone all morning with immigration attorneys and haven't paid attention much to the GOP reaction, but I did see that on the Homeland Security Committee, the top Democrat there, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, she today asked for an emergency meeting with DHS Secretary John Kelly, and she was joined by six other Democrats on that, saying, you know, giving him basically 24 hours to explain his role in the implementation of this. So that's something that's happened. Also, as regards to the wider dissent in Congress and even throughout the government, also this morning we saw a draft letter of dissent leaked from the State Department where we're told, you know, 100 or more, perhaps hundreds of Foreign Service and other employees at the State Department are signing on to this. And, you know, the draft basically describes the executive order as discriminatory and American and says that this will not make the country safer.
Well, let's bring another voice into that conversation, Jessica Vaughn. She's director of policy studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. And I'm very glad you're going to be taking part in the conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
The White House order just has said that this order, the White House has said that this order has only impacted 109 people out of the 325 foreign travelers who entered the United States on Saturday. And that is just such a small price to pay for greater security against terrorism. What do you say to this implication that people are overreacting?
I think we've just heard a little bit about of overreaction from Ms. Rubin. The idea that this and the other executive orders were drafted like on the back of a napkin over drinks one night by some campaign staff is absurd. These orders have been in the works for weeks and were written by experienced, seasoned, knowledgeable legal experts in the field. Of course there are lawsuits. That's what the ACLU does. And people who are opposed to the strict application of our immigration laws have to sue in order to try to block an action that is entirely within the authority of the president to take and necessary to take. We've had nearly 600 people convicted of terrorism or terror-related offenses since 9/11. 380 of them, at least, were foreign-born. That's two-thirds of them. They've come in as refugees. They've come in as immigrant visa holders and non-immigrant visa holders. Some of them were citizens. Some of them had green cards. It's clear that our screening and review of people that would like to be admitted to the United States is faulty and had to be addressed. We send 5 million people to secondary inspection every year at ports of entry. And yes, there were 109 people that needed to have a second look taken at them. To my knowledge, all of them were allowed into the country. So, you know, I think this really truly is a bit of an overreaction. It's an important step that's been taken so that going forward we can have the confidence to be able to admit people temporary suspension in admissions from countries that were identified by the Obama administration as the most concerning.
Backing up a bit, because there's concern about assumptions, how do we know that any substantive legal review went into this or how this was drafted and what the prep was? The White House, has it been open about that?
Well, all the legal justification for it appears in the executive orders. They cite the section of the law, 212F, that gives the president the authority to take this action. They cite the 2015 legislation that Congress and President Obama agreed on identifying the seven countries where travelers needed additional screening. It's, you know, an internet search can find you easily the legal justification for it. The Congressional Research Service has written about it. Just knowing the people who wrote these, or I mean, if you look, the transition teams for the involved agencies are available publicly so anyone can see what their credentials are. So I think it's just a little bit distracting to accuse some of, you know, folks that, you know, people have differences of opinion with of, you know, being involved in something that was clearly much more organized than they would like to believe.
Well, do you agree, though, that customs officials struggle to know how to enforce this?
That happens every time a law is changed or guidance changes. It's just, I mean, there's no perfect implementation of a change in policy. And, you know, there are always people who are unlucky enough to be caught in that brief period of time when it's been implemented. But again, I have not heard of a single individual who is actually prevented from entering the United States.
Well, let's pose that question to my next guest. James Zogby is president of the Arab American Institute. He was also a member of President Obama's U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So our guest, Jessica Vaughn, said she didn't think of can't think of a single person who was prevented entry into the United States who should have been. Can you speak to that?
Well, I know that the president accuses it of being fake news, but the New York Times today has a full page of profiles of individuals who were either denied access, being denied ability to get on a plane, or were turned away. There was a Syrian Christian family doctor coming to the United States, had a house bought for them by their family in Allentown. They were turned away in Harrisburg and sent back. There were two young men coming from Yemen who had visas, who arrived here, were put on a plane, sent back to Ethiopia, where they're now in detention because Ethiopia doesn't know what to do with them, can't send them back to Yemen. Incidentally, that Syrian family is now back in Damascus. There are dozens of stories. Actually, the 109 were those detained, some of whom have now been released and let in. But there were far more than that, a couple hundred who actually were either denied the ability to board a plane or were arrived here and were sent back. Let me make a larger point. It's not about, I mean, it's rather disingenuous to say 109 out of 325,000. I mean, we could argue 109 out of 7 billion people in the world. That's a phony number. The real number is cutting our refugee quota in half down to 50,000, denying access for anyone from seven countries means that a lot of Yemeni American families and Syrian American families and Iranian American families whose loved ones have either applied for and are in the process of receiving visas or have already received visas, but they will not now be able to come. This affects ultimately tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of people.
And I want to pick up on that in the second half of our conversation. So sit tight. We're going to take a break now, and then we're going to talk some more about the fallout from President Trump's executive travel ban order. And later on our talking point, Trump's standoff with the president of Mexico over immigration is hardly a face-off between arch nemeses. We'll hear an argument that Mexico's president laid the foundation for the wall. Stay with us. This is To the Point from PRI. This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And let's get back to our conversation about President Trump's sweeping executive order closing the border to refugees and others from seven Muslim majority countries. The travel ban had left green card and legal U.S. visa holders stranded or detained. It sparked protests at major and regional airports around the country and inspired challenges in four federal courts so far. Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies. Before the break, James Zoghbi, the president of the Arab American Institute, our guest, made the point that the reverberations of this order affect many, many more than the 109 people the White House is claiming this order is limited to so far, 3 days in. I'd like your response to his comments.
Yes, and I should have been clear, there, none of the 109 who were caught up in the transition to the new rules was prevented from coming into the United States, as far as has been reported. Of course, it does affect people going forward, but let's remember that this is a temporary suspension of the refugee admissions for Syrians and these admissions of folks from the seven countries that were identified. It's not saying we're never letting anyone in from any of these places. What the executive order says is we need to figure out what information we need to be collecting in order to have safe immigration programs. And then once we figure that out, and we have 3 months to do it in the case of the visas and 4 months to do it in the case of other classes covered by the order, at that point, then we'll decide if we can continue with these programs. And I think and expect that they will be able to restart some of these programs. But this is a temporary suspension, and it's going to end up improving the security of our immigration program so people have confidence in them going forward.
Well, let's get to the constitutionality question. President Trump has repeatedly said this is not a Muslim ban. It's not about religion. But he's also said he's concerned about Christian refugees, and part of the order guarantees preferential treatment to Christians from these seven Muslim-majority countries. So is this a Muslim ban or not?
No, of course it's not a Muslim ban. And I should add that there are built into the executive order special exceptions that are available for people in especially compelling circumstances, whether they're ill, whether someone decides that it really is in the public interest to let them in. For example, the case of that General Kelly was talking about, the translators who worked for us in Iraq. I didn't see the word Muslim anywhere in the order. There are lots of Muslim countries or who the countries that are predominantly Muslim that are not covered at all by this order. The idea is that these are the seven countries that were identified by Congress and the Obama administration as being either failed states, state sponsors of terrorism, or countries from which we just couldn't have a lot of confidence in the vetting that we were already doing. So that's why they were chosen.
Let's bring in another voice to the conversation, Kirk Johnson. He's founder of The List, the project to resettle Iraqi allies. He's the author of To Be a Friend is Fatal, and he also coordinated the reconstruction of Fallujah for USAID. And it's very good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, a number of the people who've worked as allies, whether in intelligence or interpreters for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been caught up in this sudden and, as our guest points out, allegedly temporary ban and denied entry. And vets are speaking out about this. Tell us about the situation, who's been affected, and what vets have to say about the executive order.
Sure. And, you know, I have to say I admire your guest's willingness to try to defend this executive order on as though it was something to be proud of or that it was well thought out. I was on the phone with senior officials at the State Department as he was signing it, and they were refreshing the White House Gov website to try to lay their eyes on it because they had no idea what President Trump was asking them to do. I was going to give her the benefit of the doubt until she said two things. One, that there aren't people that are being prevented from coming, which is utter provable nonsense, and two, that she has just suggested that there was some kind of exemption put in place for our interpreters also leads me to believe that she hasn't even read this thing. Now, I have to tell you, this is the reality that not 109 people are facing. This is the reality that tens of thousands of Iraqis who have bled for our country, who have risked their lives. Many of them have dragged U.S. soldiers and Marines out of firefights. They've lost limbs. They've had their loved ones killed. Many of my former colleagues have been assassinated because they're seen as traitors for standing up alongside the United States. Their wives have been raped. Their children have been abducted. And as a result of this chaos that their choice to help the United States put them in, over the past 10 years, and I don't know if Donald Trump knows this, I don't know if your guest knows this, maybe she fought against it, I'm not really interested in her point of view at the moment, but a bipartisan coalition has recognized a debt to these people, and they promised them tens of thousands of visas. There were years of hurdles for these Iraqis to go through. You don't get to ride in a Humvee alongside Marines without us knowing who you are. My colleagues had polygraph examinations routinely. Their eyeballs were scanned. These people have U.S. Marines and aid workers and diplomats vouching for them on official letterhead. They went through every step of the process. They did everything the United States government asked of them. And for that, they were granted a visa, which Donald Trump's signature has just nullified. I have people who were on their way to the airport when he was signing this, whose boarding passes were ripped up in front of their face, and they were told that Donald Trump doesn't want them in America. And these are people who have served alongside our forces.
Jessica Vaughn at the Center for Immigration Studies, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that.
That's simply not true. This is a temporary suspension. None of them have been told you are not ever coming to the United States. They've been told that you need to wait until we can be sure that the process is good. And General Kelly has made a statement that he is pushing for those types of cases that my other guest is describing to be allowed to come before, in lieu of the suspension. In other words, that they would be the exact kind of exception to the policy that is allowed under the plain text in the executive order.
Kirk Johnson, back to you. And could you talk about just how extreme the vetting already is for refugees and others that they're subjected to when they are coming from Muslim-majority countries?
Sure. This is baffling to me that somebody could try to defend this. And when you say that it's temporary, I just need your listeners to understand what this means. Now, one of the people that I'm referring to, whose ticket was torn up in front of her, waited over 2 years for her special immigrant visa, which was created by both Republicans and Democrats and promised to these people. In order to get that visa, over 2 years, she submitted her documents. She went to interviews with agents from the Department of Homeland Security. Her eyeballs were scanned, her fingerprints were taken and checked against massive databases of unexploded ordnance that were picked up from the battlefield. She had her husband, who was an interpreter for the 3rd Armored Cav for 2 years, who is now in the United States as of a few months ago, and who has also dragged American soldiers out of firefights after they've been shot. This woman was granted, and I'm not sure your guests understand or your readers or your listeners understand, you're not granted a visa for an indefinite period of travel time. You're given a window during which to travel. Now, this woman waited 2 years for her visa, which expires in March. She has to travel before March. Guess what? March is in that 90-day ban. So during that period, a whole lot of people's visas are going to expire, and they're going to have to start this whole process over again. Now,
we're talking money, we're talking time, we're talking lives completely disrupted.
I know people who have sold their houses, their cars, they've sold their family jewelry, everything they can, because they got a travel date from the United States government.
Kirk
and
Johnson,
now they don't know what to do.
You have written about this in The New Yorker, and I understand that you're not on Twitter, and someone said, look, you've got to be on Twitter if you want President Trump to hear you, if you want to get his ears. So you joined, you posted your first tweet, and tell us what you wrote and what happened with your entry into social media.
Oh, I don't know that I'm ever going to tweet again, but all I wanted to do, because there are just these basic falsehoods about what is going on, that people don't understand that these people are the most documented refugees on the face of the planet. I don't know if your guest has ever been issued a U.S. government ID. I don't know if they understand what it means to get a U.S. military issued badge or what it means to hold certificates of commendation from U.S. generals for their work. But I wanted to try to just, in a sober moment, and obviously you can hear I'm animated at the moment.
Sure.
But to walk through what these Iraqis did for us and mm-hmm. to try to get through to President Trump, because right now, whoever is advising him is not serving him well.
Right. And you wrote that you served in Iraq as USAID's man in Fallujah, and you lived alongside Marines and interpreters as they fought terrorists. That was your simple tweet, at real Donald Trump. What happened?
As of last check, it's got to be approaching 20,000 retweets, but I don't really even care about, like, all I want is one person to read that. And that's the President of the United States, and I hope to God he does, because I'm just trying, not from any partisan angle, not from any left-right thing. I don't even care who's in the White House. This is just a basic American principle that I'm trying to defend against this idiotic order.
Kirk Johnson, I want to turn back to James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute. We were talking about with Jessica Vaughn whether this is a Muslim ban. She says absolutely not. What's your take?
Well, Rudy Giuliani sort of spilled the beans, as it were, on TV shows yesterday, saying the president told him, find me a Muslim ban, make it work.
That was in an interview on Fox.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of partway there. It's not a ban of all Muslims, to be sure. But what it does do is open the door for a broader application, as the administration has made clear. And by creating a religious preference test, which is what they say that they will do by prioritizing persecuted minorities, meaning Christians. They don't mean Sunnis in Iraq or Shia in Syria. They mean Christians. They put basically a target on the back of Christians across the Middle East. And I am an Arab American who is a Christian, and I have very close ties with Christians in the Middle East. The last thing on earth they want is preferential treatment. They want to get in line just like everybody else. And many of them have gotten in line, and many of them have come, either as refugees or immigrants, fewer as refugees, more as immigrants, or come over on special waivers that they've gotten.
Are you speaking from your experience? Because when you were on the Commission on International Religious Freedom, conservatives were clamoring to let more Christians from Muslim-majority nations
We argued that was simply a wrong-headed approach, that refugee status ought to be given to the most vulnerable. And in some instances, it is Christians. In other instances, it is Sunni Muslims or Shia Muslims or people of no faith at all who are in very dire circumstances. And the numbers of those who've come and the fact that the President Obama raised that limit was something that we were clamoring for and we got. The fact that now that number is going to be halved means a whole lot of very desperate people at a time when we're in a migration crisis throughout the world. America not only doesn't step up to the plate, but actually removes the plate from those who are most desperate and need it. Let me just make a point about the issue of terrorism. The paper that Steve Miller, who's in the White House now, who's one of the architects of this, wrote for Jeff Sessions that argued 580 people have been foreigners, have been implicated in terrorist acts since 9/11, that's simply a bogus report and ought to be taken apart and looked at very carefully, because when you come down to it, the number is actually significantly smaller. 580 accused of crimes, some of them originally charged with terrorism, but there was no evidence, and so they actually got arrested and convicted on issues like stealing cigarettes or on faking their tax reports, et cetera. The issue is a very small number of actual foreigners, and only two refugees over the last 15 years have been implicated in acts of violence here in America. Understand the far greater danger. If President Trump really wanted to protect the American people from violence, he ought to do something about handguns, something about semi-automatic weapons, something about people with mental illness having the ability to get guns and buy large numbers of guns in states across the country.
Speaking to what the public thinks of of this order and of this policy. What do you make of people showing up at airports, and not just the major ones, but even smaller ones that don't have that much international travel, like Fresno or Birmingham or Nashville? What does this tell us about how the order is resonating with Americans?
You know, it actually filled me with tears as I watched this unfold over the last 2 days, because I said to myself, number one, this is the soul of America speaking. And number two, it's saving American lives across the Middle East. I poll in the Middle East. All the years that we have betrayed our values in our policies across that region, I shuddered. And when we polled, we would find that they hate our policy, but they still like us because they like our values. And they like our freedom and democracy, and they say that in the polls. If Donald Trump continues on the path he's on, we're going to lose that too. And so when I look at the airports and I see these thousands of people cheering for folks as they're getting off the plane saying, welcome, America's a welcoming country, people in the Middle East are watching that and they're saying, you know what, America's really not that bad. This is a good place of good people.
And I think I'm afraid we're out of time, and that's a perfect place to stop. I want to thank you, all of you, Kirk Johnson with The List, James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, who was just speaking, Jessica Vaughn with the Center for Immigration Studies, and Jennifer Rubin with The Washington Post. Earlier, we heard from Hannah Alam with McClatchy. Thanks to all of you. Just ahead, our next guest says Mexico's president helped put Trump in the White House. Is he to blame for the current U.S.-Mexico standoff over the wall? We're back with that on today's Talking Point. I'm Barbara Bogave here with today's Talking Point. The president of Mexico will not be at the White House this week as planned. It's a result of the Trump administration's first foreign policy fight with an ally and trading partner. All the talk of building a wall and a border tax to pay for it was too much political pressure for President Enrique Peña Nieto to tolerate. But if this standoff gives the impression that Trump and Peña Nieto are polar opposites, that's not the case. The two men are more alike than they may seem. And that's according to John Ackerman. He's professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He's also a newspaper columnist and editor-in-chief of the Mexican Law Review. Good to talk with you.
A pleasure to talk with you, Barbara. Be on the show as always.
Okay, so despite this tit-for-tat over a sit-down, how similar are Trump and Peña Nieto? What do they have in common?
Well, they really share a similar worldview. We can go right to the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala to see that clearly. Peña Nieto, during his last 4 years, has been building up the equivalent of a wall.
A very high-tech wall.
A high-tech wall in southern Mexico to keep out those Guatemalans, those Central Americans. This has, of course, been on the bidding of Obama and the United States administration. But in general, Peña Nieto has been governing Mexico in that way, as if he's a client of the United States. He's very well-behaved, we could say, if not servile to the United States. And in general, he's also a president who is more interested in, you know, grand corporate politics and not so much about taking care of his people and his migrants. And so in that way, he's also parallel to Trump. The fact that Peña Nieto actually canceled this meeting, well, you know, it was Trump who pushed him out, right? But the Peña Nieto, in the end, canceled his attendance, is a tribute to the force of the Mexican people, because Peña Nieto himself was basically willing to do anything to get that meeting, and he had to step out because of the pressure on the ground from Mexican civil society, who just could not deal with these blatant attacks and aggressions against Mexico and Mexicans.
Do they share similar approval ratings as well?
Well, Peña Nieto is much lower, even lower. Peña Nieto has only 12% favorable rating in Mexico. This is the lowest for any Mexican president in ever since these polls have been done in Mexico, 20, 30 years. He is in the middle of a very intense situation with protests on the streets. because of his policies, the increase in gas prices, the privatization of oil. Peña Nieto is definitely not a favorite of the Mexicans themselves.
So getting back to the standoff over the meeting, what was Peña Nieto hoping to gain by being an early visitor to the White House? And I'm gathering it must have been a lot, because you're right, he was prepared to sell his country down the river for it.
Yes, he's desperate. And even if you notice, the day after the Twitter spat between Trump and Peña Nieto grabbed the phone and, you know, made that make-up call. Sorry, Trump. And they talked for about an hour on the telephone. And secretly, the information was not made public. He's afraid about the end of NAFTA, that this could just collapse the Mexican economy. He's also bargaining for his own impunity in the future. Peña Nieto is on his way out. Next year, there'll be elections in 2018. And if Peña Nieto doesn't have the protection of the Trump administration, he could be in serious hot water for a long series of corruption scandals, human rights violations, massacres committed by federal police and the military. So he's concerned about saving his own skin as well.
And how are Mexicans reacting to this kerfuffle? Because even before last week's events, Mexicans were talking about boycotting U.S. products and burning Trump piñatas.
Yes, there is definitely a feeling. This has touched a profound nerve, not only this question of Peña Nieto, but from a long time ago, ever since Trump started talking about Mexicans as being racist and this kind of racist talk, and Trump's racist talk. So this has definitely touched a nerve within the Mexican population, and it's taking out creating an upswell of, I don't know if it's nationalist feeling, but, you know, national pride, and these boycotts are starting to happen. It looks like this might turn into a full-fledged boycott of Walmart. Citibank, for instance, is the only American bank in Mexico, which bought up the old Mexican bank, the Banamex. Starbucks has taken over Mexico over the last 3 or 4 years. And so there are plenty of targets to direct that anger and that national pride.
And I would think one more target is this floated idea of a border adjustment tax as a way to fund the construction of a border wall. Given that this policy ends up taking money out of American consumers' pockets for the goods that they buy from Mexico to pay for the wall, what are Mexicans making of that? How's it playing in the press?
Well, I think the Americans, United States citizens, need to face up to the fact that this wall, if it's built, will be on the shoulders of the American people. This Sunday in the New York Daily News, I went point for point to all the different possible scenarios or strategies to making Mexico pay for the wall. To me, none of them are feasible or legal. There's no real possibility that Mexico will ever actually pay for this wall. And that's also the feeling on the ground here in Mexico. It's impossible, I think, for even Peña Nieto, who would love to pay for the wall if he could get away with it. But even he wouldn't be able to get away with it, because it would just be such an egregious violation of national sovereignty and pride that they're going to have to find some other indirect ways of doing it, through these taxes, for instance, or through remittances. But all these things are going to have serious effects not only on Mexico but also on the United States. So there's no easy way out for Trump.
And there's no easy way out for Peña Nieto either. I mean, who loses in a trade war between the U.S. and Mexico? Mexico depends on the U.S. more than vice versa, no?
Well, they both depend greatly on each other. Of course, the United States economy is much more powerful and diversified than the Mexican. But, you know, it would be hard for the United States to weather out a serious trade war with Mexico. Mexico is the 15th largest economy in the world. It's the third largest trade partner with the United States. They could inflict some serious damage on the United States and creating, you know, inflation, raising in prices and taxes all over the place. So it's not a simple bargain. Although, yes, Mexico is, of course, the subordinate partner in this relationship. And that's why Trump and Peña Nieto are still sort of clutching onto each other. That's why this phone call last Friday, and that's why they haven't actually broken off relations.
And speaking to the legal workings of this, the Trump administration has talked about trying to tax remittances, and that's the money that sent from the U.S. back to family members across the border. How does that work? Would that work legally?
Well, there's a memo that Trump put out, I think it was March of last year when he was campaigning, a two-page memo in which he outlined this strategy for basically, you know, sequestering, kidnapping the remittances for a while until the Mexican government folded and agreed to pay over the fork over the cash for the wall. The problem with this strategy of holding back the remittances is basically what you'd have to do is apply the Patriot Act to make it illegal to transfer money out of the country for people who are not full-fledged American citizens, as if they were necessarily, just because of that fact, a terrorist threat. So you basically have to put all Mexican undocumented migrants into the category of potential terrorists in order to stop all transfers of money. That's a doubtful legal strategy, although, you know, Trump has shown that he's not exactly committed to the details on these issues. So, but it wouldn't be easy to do.
Well, indulge me. From 0 to 100%, what are the chances of Mexico paying for the wall?
Maybe 5% maximum. I don't think it's going to happen.
I thought you were going to go into negative numbers.
Yeah, we could do a negative number too. But, you know, I mean, anything's possible. Peñanito could totally fold and immediately after paying be kicked out of his seat as president of Mexico as a sort of a final sacrifice to save his own skin. That's the only scenario I can imagine.
John Ackerman, professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you very much, Barbara. Pleasure.
And that's it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney. I'll be back with you tomorrow. And I hope to see you for To the Point. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.